Okay, I'll call this meeting, the House Finance Committee, to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:41 p.m. on Tuesday, April 29th, 2025. And present today, we've got Representative Hannon, Representative Johnson, Representative Bynum, Co-Chair Shragi, Co-Chair Josephson, Representative Jimmy, Representative Galvin, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Stapp, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And if folks can mute their cell phones, if you haven't already done so. And we only have one presentation for us today. That's House Bill 78. That's the PERS bill. And we have a presentation from Gallagher on the results from the actuarial report. At the end of the meeting, we will be adopting a committee substitute, and then we'll be setting an amendment deadline. And we do have some natural breaks here. Maybe if folks could look at their slide deck here. We've got 38 slides before us. And what we're hoping to do is maybe hold off on questions. Oh, we've also got with us Representative Allard. We're hoping to hold off on questions until after each kind of natural section. So if you look at page 2 of your slide deck in the contents, we're going to hold questions. So if you could write your questions down, but we thought it would be good if we could get through the entire overview section. So that's page slides 4 through 10. If we get through those first, and then we'll take questions. And then we'll take the next round of questions after the next section, which is an example, FY26 additional state contributions. And then we'll take questions after actuarial assumptions for evaluations and so forth. So, again, if folks could just write their questions down, and I'll keep a lookout. I can put people in the queue as we go along, but just in case folks are wondering why I'm not taking the questions, maybe on that slide, I'm just waiting for us to get to the end of that section. So with that, I would like to invite up with Gallagher, Mr. David Kirshner, an actuary from Gallagher, and if you would like to put yourself on the record. Also, I'd like to note that we do have available for questions from Division of Retirement and Benefits, Kathy Lee, Division Director, Chris Novel, CFO for the division, and Mike Mole with Chiron. And let's see, I think I've got everything. So with that, welcome, Mr. Kirshner, if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is David Kirshner. I'm an actuary with Gallagher. Buck has been the plan actuary for the state's retirement system since 2006. Excuse me. And I've personally been involved since 2015. In 2023, Buck was acquired by Arthur J. Gallagher & Company, which is a global risk management insurance and consulting firm. And in July of last year, after over a 100-year legacy, the Buck name was retired officially, and now we're known as Gallagher. So I am here today to present the findings from our fiscal note analysis related to HB 78. So before we get into the specifics of HB 78, I thought it would be helpful to provide an overview of how PERS and TERS are funded under the Alaska statutes, because sometimes there are some subtleties involved, as we'll see when we look at some of the examples, which sometimes those subtleties get lost in fully understanding why costs are projected to increase. Then we'll talk about the assumptions that we use for both, how the assumptions are set for the annual evaluations that the ARM Board adopts for the contribution rates. Then we'll talk about the assumptions specific to HB 78 and how they relate to the ongoing assumptions for the valuations. I'll touch briefly on some of the risk-sharing provisions within HB 78 and some of the other economic considerations. And then, starting on slide 26, we'll summarize some of the key information from our March 24th fiscal note letter that provides some specific numbers to HB 78. And hopefully, if there's time, if your eyes haven't glazed over, by the time we get to the example, starting on slide 31, hopefully the example will help illustrate why why we're projecting costs contributions to increase. So PERS and TERS are funded under Alaska statutes. There are basically two sources of funding for the retirement systems. One is the investment income on the investment earnings on the invested assets, and then contributions. And we have three sources of contributions. We have the employer contributions, member contributions, and the state contributions. So looking at the employer contributions under PERS, we have two different groups. The non-state employers contribute 22% of total payroll. And that, when I say total payroll, that includes both defined benefit and defined contribution retirement members, those that were hired on or after June of 2006. Under PERS, the state as an employer, instead of contributing just 22%, the state as an employer contributes the full actuarial rate based on the total payroll of its employees, which is just under 50% of the total PERS payroll. And then TERS, Teachers Retirement System, employers contribute 12.56% of total payroll. Again, total payroll is defined benefit and defined contribution retirement members. The member contributions are fixed. Under PERS, peace officers and firefighters contribute 7.5% of pay. All other PERS members contribute 6.75% of pay, and TERS members contribute 8.65% of pay. You're going to see a lot of terminology, the actuarial determined contribution, which is often acronym the ADC or the ADEC. But the defined benefit plan, the actuarially determined contribution, consists of two components. One is called the normal cost, which is the actuarial cost of benefits that are expected to accrue in the upcoming year. As active members earn one more year of service, they accrue additional benefits, and the cost of that those benefits is called the normal cost. And then we have the second component is the past service cost, which is the paying down the unfunded liability over a 25-year period as defined in the statutes. And as required by statutes, these components are calculated separately for the pension trust and the healthcare trust, and then we combine them all together, and we'll see that when we get to the example. The normal costs for the defined benefit plan are covered by members and member contributions and employer contributions. The employers also contribute the costs for the defined contribution retirement plan, the DCR plan, and that includes four different benefits: occupational death and disability benefits, health care benefits, employer defined contribution amounts, which are 5% for PERS members and 7% for TERS, and then 3% health reimbursement account contributions. And a portion of the employer contribution also goes toward the defined benefit past service costs, to pay down the unfunded liability, and that is calculated as the total employer contribution minus the amount that they've paid toward the normal cost, and then minus the DCR costs. And this portion of the employer contribution is important, as we're going to see in the examples, because depending on how much the employers contribute toward the unfunded liability determines how much the state has to pay to make up the difference. And so the defined benefit past service costs that is not paid by the employers is paid by the state via the additional state contributions. And the additional state contributions can increase due to basically two changes. One is if the cost of the underlying benefits change, and then the second, which is a little bit more of the subtle difference, which is not fully understood sometimes, is the changes in the distribution of the employer contributions. And when we get to the FY30 example under HB 78, you'll see how the distribution of the employer contributions can have a big impact on the projected state contributions. The past service cost, which is paying down the unfunded liability. The unfunded liability is the difference between the actuarial accrued liability and the actuarial value of assets. The actuarial accrued liability is the present value of future benefits expected to be paid for current members, both active and inactive members, that's attributable to service as of the date of calculation. So that's why it's an accrued liability. The actuarial value of assets is a market-related value. As we know, particularly over the last few weeks, we see the market value can bounce up and down. And if we use the market value of assets to determine the contributions, as the market value goes up and down, the contributions would go up and down as well. So as an attempt to help smooth out the impact of market ups and downs on contribution volatility, we use what's called an actuarial value of assets, which is a smooth market value. We recognize the market gains and losses over a five-year period. So every year that we have a market gain or a loss, we recognize 20% of that in the smooth value and then the remaining 80% over the successive 4 years. When we do annual valuations, we know that we're going to have unexpected changes in the unfunded liability, and there's really five sources for potential changes in the unfunded liability. The first is what were the asset returns for the year, and how did those returns compare to what we expected, which currently is 7.25%. The second component is changes in the data that drive the liabilities. So every year we get updated data, and we compare what we thought was going to happen to the last year's data based on our assumptions, and then we compare that to what actually happened, and that gives us the experience for the liabilities. We can also have changes in the unfunded liability due to contributions greater or less than the actuarially determined contribution. For example, in 2015, the state contributed $3 billion, $1 billion to PERS and $2 billion to TERS. And since those were greater than the actuarially determined contribution, that produced a contribution gain, which reduced the unfunded liability for that year. We're going to talk about the actuarial assumptions, but anytime we change the actuarial assumptions, that impacts the accrued liability. The change in actuarial assumptions could be both a positive or negative impact on the accrued liability. That can change as well. And then usually when we change plan provisions, it's prospective only, like introducing a new tier of benefits, for example. But to the extent that we change plan provisions that affect service prior to the date of the change, that can change the unfunded liability as well. The current funding methodology for PERS and TERS was established in 2014 by Alaska statutes. And the key elements of that funding methodology was the amortization method for the unfunded liability was changed from what's called level dollar to level percentage of pay. Level dollar is like a home mortgage where you have a outstanding principal and you amortize that or you pay it down over 15 or 30 years. It's the same amount every year. That's level dollar. Under level percentage of pay, the amortization amounts are assumed to increase as your payroll is projected to increase. And when we compare level dollar amounts with level percentage of pay, the amounts under level percentage of pay start out lower in the earlier years, and then they cross over at some point, usually around 10 years or so, and then they're greater than the level dollar amounts. On a present value basis, they're the same, equal to the unfunded liability. It's just a different pattern. The amortization period was reset to 25 years in 2014. So at that point, the PERS and TERS trusts were expected to be 100% funded by 2039. We also, another change was the contribution rate setting process was changed instead of using the most recent valuation. It's set on a two-year lag, which helps set the contributions in advance of the fiscal year starting. So, for example, the FY26 contributions that are going into effect in July of this year were set based on the 2023 valuations, and those were adopted in September of last year. So that's the two-year roll forward or two-year lag. And then finally, in 2014, the actuarial value of assets was reset to market value with the five-year smoothing method implemented on a prospective basis. And then in 2018, the ARM board changed the amortization method, and we introduced what's called a layered amortization, which essentially every year's change in the unfunded liability is amortized over a separate 25-year period. So every time we have an unexpected change in the unfunded liability, that creates a new layer, which is then amortized over 25 years. And the only reason for making that change was, again, to help control volatility on the state's contributions as that original 25-year period were to get smaller and smaller. The effect of introducing layered amortization is that the date, 2039, which was the date that we expected the plans to be fully funded, that date is now extended into the future, because every time we have a new layer created, that 25-year clock starts from that point forward. So based on the most recent valuations, we are now projecting the pension trusts for both PERS and TERS to be 100% funded by 2048. And the healthcare trusts for both PERS and TERS are currently over 100% funded and are expected to remain so going forward. The next two slides are not at all related to HB 78. They're really provided for informational purposes. In recent House Finance Committee and Senate Finance Committee meetings, there's been a lot of questions as to why the unfunded liabilities have continued to grow since the $3 billion was contributed. So we put these charts together for the ARM board, and I thought it would be helpful for the committee as well. So slide 9 is the changes in the unfunded liability for PERS pension since 2014, and then the following slide is TERS. The first column are the gains and losses on the market value of assets. So, for example, if our assumed return is 7.25 and the plan market return is 10%, that's a gain because we earned more than we expected. Column B are the associated smooth value of actuarial value gains and losses based on the market gains and losses in column A. So if you look at 2021, for example, that was a phenomenal year, the year ending 6/30/21, where your plans, as well as many other plans across the country, had great returns. In fact, the market return was a little over 30%, which you don't see very often. And then you can see the very next year, we had a $1.6 billion loss because we lost almost all of the gains that we had in the prior year. So you can see how the market value gains and losses can be quite volatile from one year to the next. Column C are the gains and losses on the liabilities due to the unexpected changes in the participant data from one year to the next. And then column D are the gains and losses due to contributions, either greater or less than the actual determined contribution. So you can see in 2015 we had an $835 million contribution gain for PERS. That's the difference between the $1 billion that was contributed compared to the actuarial rate for that year. And then finally, column E are the assumption changes, and we're going to talk about the assumptions in a minute, but every 4 years, as required by Alaska statutes, we undergo an experience study, and the assumptions are potentially changed every 4 years, and so the impact on the unfunded liability due to those assumption changes is shown in column E. And then the last column is the net increase or decrease in the unfunded liability from columns B through E. So if you look in the lower right corner, you can see that over these 10 years, the PERS pension unfunded liability has increased by $325 million, more than we expected it to. A large portion of that is due to the assumption changes in column E, where we added over $750 million in liability. And that was primarily due to the lowering of the expected return assumption. Back in 2014, the assumption was 8%. And then in 2018, that was lowered to 7.38%. And then it was further lowered to where it currently is in 2022 to 7.25. And when you lower the assumed return, liabilities go up because you're assuming that you're going to earn less earnings on those invested assets. So the liabilities are higher. And then slide 10 is similar information for TERS. I won't go through it, but you can see in 2015, column D, $1.5 billion contribution gain. Of the $2 billion that was contributed in 2015 to TERS, $1.7 billion went to the pension trust, and about $300 million went to the healthcare trust. So the $1.5 billion gain is the difference between the $1.7 billion that was contributed and the amount that was required based on the actuarial calculations. So I know I went through all of that information pretty quickly, but I want to make sure we have enough time for the HB 78 specific information.
Great, thank you very much. So that takes us through this section dealing with the overview. And I do have a question from Representative Josephson. Representative Stapp, did you have a question? Okay, Representative Josephson, Stapp. Oh, no question. Okay. So I do have Stapp, Bynum, Hannon, Galvin. So with that, Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, I have a few here trying to take notes. First one is, can you just walk me through layered amortization compounding multiple times? Because I get the math in my head. So basically, we amortized it for 25 years in 2015. Assumptions change, so we layer amortization on top of that, and then we push out that liability to 100%, it's like 2048 now. The problem in my head is we are dealing with people, and we can't just push that number out to like 2095 because they're not going to live that long. So help me understand that through the chair.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Stapp, that's correct. The analogy the best analogy I can give you is think of if you have your home mortgage, your first mortgage, your main mortgage, that's the unfunded liability that was created in 2014 that's going to be amortized over 25 years. And then every year you go out and get a new home equity line of credit. And that line of credit is then funded over a 25-year period. So each time you get a new line of credit, that line of credit is then, it's a new layer, essentially, and that is then funded over 25 years. When the ARM board considered adopting layered amortization, there was a lot of discussion, particularly since PERS and TERS are closed to new entrants, of whether we should be using something shorter than 25 years. And the opinion from the legal department was because the statutes specifically say that the unfunded liability must be amortized or shall be amortized, I may be not using exact words, over a 25-year period using level percentage of pay amortization, it was felt at the time to avoid potential conflict with the statutes, we should keep the period at 25 years. Now, we are going to, the next experience study will be performed next year, and we've already had some discussions at the ARM board meetings about changing the 25-year to something shorter, particularly if the DB plan, the defined benefit plans, continue to remain closed. So that 25-year period, to address your concern, is do we keep sort of kicking the can down the road? But it was, again, primarily done to reduce volatility. And I'll give you sort of the most hypothetical example. If we had not introduced layered amortization, and suppose we were in 2038 and we had a $1 billion loss in the markets because, for whatever reason, that $1 billion would have to be funded immediately because we only had 1 year left. So that was the reason why we introduced layered amortization, was to help mitigate contribution volatility to the state.
Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. So I'm going to just tap on this real quick again, and then I'm going to go to something else. So, I agree with you. It's like I said, it makes sense in my head why you would utilize that rather than like a condor method or something like that. But I guess the issue I have, because the plan is closed, right, and there are people at the end, you have cash outflows going to people. That's our liability, right? So I guess in my mind, and I'm glad that you're here, I can't say, well, I'm just going to layer this assumption change out till, let's say, 2070, because my actual participants on the plan are going to be like getting those cash outflows. And if they're not around to get the cash outflows, then, which in theory they wouldn't be in 2080, right, because the plan's closed, wouldn't I have to have a shorter period of time that I layer my amortization? Otherwise, I'm just kind of pretending I have this liability in out years that I'm not going to have to pay. So I guess the analogy of the house, I totally get that, but the house is going to be a house for a while. Like a person has a finite, you know, amount of time, correct? Through the chair?
Yeah. Mr. Kirshner?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Stapp, you're correct. And so that's why we've had some discussions already at the ARM board meetings about shortening that amortization period. I would, if I had to guess right now, we would probably at the next experience study, we would probably, if the defined benefit plans remain closed, we'll probably lower that to 15 years. Is if I had to guess right now, that's probably what will happen. So that, but keep in mind that by 2039. The lion's share of the unfunded liability will be fully funded because that 25-year period that was introduced in 2014 was not changed by the layered amortization. That was still in place. So that's our first layer. So in 2018, we had 21 years left of that 25-year period. So that is still being fully funded by 2039. It's the successive layers after 2018 that have their own 25-year period.
Representative Stout?
Yeah, I think Co-Chair Foster's the chair. Okay, that makes sense. It's like pyramid, and every little layer gets a little smaller as it goes up. Okay. Second question I have, regarding the formula you gave, the total employer contribution minus employer portion of the DB normalized cost and your level percent of pay when you run these, when you run your actuarials, how do you model percent of payroll growth? Right, because it would seem to me in my head that kind of the payroll growth is a pretty big deal if you're using total employer contributions minus employer portion of normal costs. Through the chair,
Mr. Kirshner.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Stapp. That's correct. And so the payroll growth assumption historically has been set as the inflation rate plus some margin. Prior to 2018, it was the inflation rate plus 50 basis points. So at the time, so for example, in 2014, the inflation rate was 3.12. So we were using a payroll growth assumption of 3.62%. And in 2018, we lowered that margin. We shrunk that margin from 50 basis points to 25 basis points. So right now, our inflation assumption is 2.5%. So our payroll growth assumption is 2.75%. And that's another assumption that the ARM board is considering changing. In fact, we're running some projections right now for the June meeting to see what the impact on future state contributions would be if we lowered the payroll growth assumption, because if we look over the last 10 years, the actual payroll growth has been much lower than our assumption. So PERS payroll has grown by about 2% per year over the last 10 years, and TERS payroll has grown by about 1%. So the ARM board is considering lowering that payroll growth assumption, which would accelerate funding into the earlier years. So if we, for example, the lowest payroll growth assumption we could use is 0%. That would essentially be level dollar. So if we were to use a 1% level a payroll growth assumption instead of 2.75, that would accelerate some of the funding from future years into the earlier years, with a less steep increase in those future contributions.
Representative Stout?
Yeah, thank Co-Chair Foster. And I apologize to the committee for kind of monopolizing the first round of questions here. So through the chair, so the reason I asked the question is, you know, we just got this thing called salary study, and I think it's fairly clear that we know that we probably haven't compensated the bulk of our employees appropriately over the last decade or so when we looked at that. So my fear would be if we are kind of talking about at this table about and kind of increasing our salaries for our people, and then the ARM board is actually lowering the projections, doesn't that basically just shift that liability around through the chair?
Mr. Kirshner?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Stapp, the salary increase, there's a separate salary increase assumption that applies to, because benefits are retirement benefits under the plans are based on average pay at retirement, either a 3 or a 5 year average. So when we run an active member through our valuation system, they're projected every year. We project their pay to estimate what their projected benefits are going to be. Those projections use the salary increase assumption, which is, I think, what you've indicated are expected to increase. So if we increase our salary increase assumption, that will increase projected benefits and therefore projected liabilities. And then how fast we pay that unfunded liability down, that's the payroll growth assumption. So the payroll growth assumption is generally independent of the salary increase rates, because the payroll growth assumption is looking at payroll, total payroll and payroll in totality, which includes not only current members but new entrants that are expected to come in to replace the active members who are expected to retire. So the liabilities themselves are dependent on the individual salary increase assumption, and then how fast we pay down the unfunded liability is dependent on the size of the unfunded liability, but the payroll growth assumption.
Okay. And last one, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stout?
Yeah. Thanks, through the chair. Thanks for the explanation. Definitely helps me kind of puzzle that through. So last one here, and I think you said column C on slide 10 that we're at. You said that the change in participant data led to the losses. Actually, on slide 9, excuse me. So what does that mean, change in participant data? Does that mean that because the inflation rate was higher, our coal stuff that we're paying out went up, and therefore our liabilities increased, and we didn't assume that? Or does that mean we didn't get a better return on the fund? What does change in participant data mean? Thanks, through the chair.
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, it's all of the above, other than the expected return, the return on assets. That's in column A and B. When I say changes in the data, when we receive the data, we have some people who are currently actively employed, and we project them through some of them. Every year are subject to potential termination of employment based on our assumption. Some of them could retire if they're eligible to retire. For example, peace officers and firefighters can retire with an unreduced benefit after 20 years of service. So we have an assumption based on our experience studies, which we're going to talk about in a minute, as to how what pattern of expected retirements do we include in our valuation to determine the liabilities. We also have an inflation component, an expectation, which affects the post-retirement pension adjustments, which are linked to the Anchorage CPI index. So when I say changes in the data, every year we get new data and we say, okay, what happened during the year based on the actual data that we got? So more people may have retired than we thought. More people may have died than we thought. And more people may have terminated employment than we thought, or less. And so the comparison between the actual data changes during the year versus what we expected for the year based on the assumptions is what gives rise to the liability gains or losses. And so if we have more early retirements or more retirements than we expected, that would be a loss, because we're now paying benefits earlier than we thought and for longer periods of time. That would be a liability loss. On the flip side, if we have if we look at our current participants who are in pay status and we have a life expectancy for them based on our mortality assumption, if more people died during the year than we thought based on our mortality assumption, that's a loss to them, but it's a gain to the plan because we're no longer, unless there's a survivor benefit, they're no longer being paid a benefit. So that would be a gain. So it's a combination of all of those potential changes.
Little morbid, but I get it. Thanks.
Okay. On my list, I've got Representative Bynum, Hannon, and Galvin. And so with that, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, I'll try to make it real quick here. Representative Staff asked some of the same questions that I was going to, that I was thinking about. But if we go back to page 4, or slide 4, correction. In here, we said, and I think you mentioned it on slide 6, but or at least referred to it. But on here, we say, who pays and how much? And on here, we say, PERS, non-state employees, employers' contribution is 22% of total payroll. But I want to just clarify that I do believe that there is a delta on that. So if the actuarial is actually above the 22%, then the state picks up the additional portion of that for non-state employers. Is that accurate?
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, that's correct. That's what I referred to. We're going to see that in an example, but that's what I referred to on slide 5, the fourth bullet. It says the past service cost not paid by the employers is paid by the state by additional state contributions. Okay. Now, for PERS, state as an employer, they pay, starting in FY22, they pay the full rate. But they used to also contribute 22%.
Sure.
But now they pay the full rate.
Thank you. And then there was a lot of discussion talking through the chair. There's a lot of discussion talking about the period of time when we are the 25 period that we were talking about. And you mentioned that it's possible that we look at doing that shorter, potentially doing it shorter. Statute says 25 years. And then my question would be is that when you do shorten that time, what is the overall impact of shortening that time as far as the financial impact?
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, when you shorten the amortization period, for example, if you shorten it from 25 to 15 years, the amount that you pay in each year will go up. Just like if you get a 15-year mortgage versus a 30-year mortgage, a 15-year mortgage is going to have a higher payment because you're paying it down over a shorter period of time. Now, when you look at it in over the total period of time, you'll actually pay less because of less interest, like a 15-year mortgage versus a 30-year mortgage, but it's the same concept. When you lower the period to amortize or to pay down the unfunded liability, the payment will go up.
Representative Bynum?
Thank you. And so effectively, because of the 22% cap for non-state employers, that cost shift goes to the state, correct?
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, that's correct.
And then my final question was, is on slide 9, you gave the years in which you changed the you verbally gave us the years in which you changed the percentage from 8%, I believe, in 2014, and then all the way down into 22, it went to 7.25. I'd missed the year that there was that interim amount. What year and amount was that?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, in 2018, the 8% was lowered to 7.38%.
And then again?
And then in 2022, the 7.38 was lowered to 7.25. Now, along with the lowering of the expected return, we also lowered the inflation rate. So in 2014, when the return was 8.8%, the inflation rate was 3.12. And then in 2018, the inflation rate was lowered to 2.5%, and it stayed there where it currently is. Now, we also changed a whole list of other assumptions. We updated the mortality assumption to use more current mortality assumption, which reflects more current life expectancies. We also adjusted the salary increase rates that I was referring to earlier. We also have changed some of the retirement rates. So it's the numbers that you see here on slides 9 and 10 are not just the investment return assumption, it's a combined impact, but But if you looked at one assumption, which has the largest impact, it's always the expected return assumption has the biggest impact on the liabilities.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up, I have Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. And I appreciate the earlier questions being asked because they've led me. So my question was going to start on page 6, trying to understand liability experience, where you use the term the data on liabilities. And I was trying to understand what pieces of data. Now, I think I've come to understand that would be payroll increases so that you're predicting how much this future retiree is going to earn, and that's going to change over time. If I go to slide 9, though, now trying to follow it through, and I'm looking at, and this is that double negative. So for liabilities, a gain is bad, a loss is good for us, right? It's getting us closer. We want it to be losses, correct? In
Gains.
We want a gain on our liability.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Kirshner?
Excuse me. Through the chair, Representative Hannon. So when we say gain, a gain or loss is the difference between what we expected was going to occur and what actually occurred. And when it's that difference is favorable to the plan, it's a gain. And when it's unfavorable, it's a loss. So if we look at the asset returns, we're assuming 7.25 and we earn 10%, that's a gain. If we only earn 5% for the year, it's a loss, okay. An asset loss.
I'm looking at our liability. Okay.
And then on the liability side, so for example, if we were assuming a 2.5% inflation rate, which affects the post-retirement pension adjustments, and if you look at 2022 and 2023, we had large liability losses. Those were the high inflation years. So the post-retirement pension adjustments that actually were granted based on the changes in the CPI were higher than the 2.5% that we were assuming. So that would have created a loss to the plan because benefits that were being paid out were higher than we thought they were going to be based on the prior year's data. We can also have, like I said, we also have changes in the data from more or fewer retirements than we thought or deaths or terminations. It's all those above that go into column C.
Representative Hannon.
Okay, so following up on that, because I'm starting to be able to track you now. So thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So let's go to 2020. So in 2018, we got triple-digit gain. 2019, we're down to, you know, a third of that. And we stay there in 2020, but then we start jumping back up to triple digits. So have you looked into that data to see what happened to our liabilities in 2019 and 2020? Did more people die or fewer people retired?
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, it's basically a kitchen sink calculation. If you, I don't want to punt the question, but if you look at our detailed valuation reports in the executive summary section, we provide a table that shows the sources of those liability gains and losses, and there's usually 10 to 12 categories. We have demographic experience like retirements and terminations. We have the post-retirement pension adjustments due to the higher or lower inflation. We've got the effect of salary increases more or less than expected. So in one particular year, some of those can be gains and some of those can be losses, which in total combined to the in aggregate are the amounts shown here. So I do know that in 2022 and 2023, when we had unusually high inflation, which affected the post-retirement pension adjustments, we also saw lower than expected salary increases. And so that would have been a gain that would have offset some of the losses from the higher inflation. So it's a combination of all those factors.
Okay. And one for me. So I'm always thrown off because I'm following along with you and these numbers are making sense to me until we get to the wages because, well, I guess it's a closed system. So I am trying to figure out where in here we are capturing that no one knew was entering this system. The liability that we have is based on wages from people who are still working, but many of the people that the, in the liability that we're trying to pay out benefits, they're long gone from contributing to the system. So maybe it's not capturable in this liability gain and loss, and I should just be done with trying to understand an actuarial and trust that you are able to predict things that I just don't think make sense in my mind of, Okay. Thank you.
If I could clarify that through the chair, Representative Hannon. So people that are already retired, there are two things that can cause a gain or a loss for their liabilities. One is if they received a post-retirement pension adjustment, either greater or less than we thought, based on what happened to the Anchorage CPI increase versus the 2.5% that we assumed. And then how many of the retirees are still around that we thought, if we had, say, 10,000 retirees, we might have assumed 1,000 of them were going to, in aggregate, were going to die for the year. It wouldn't be that high. It would probably be closer to 2%, not 10%. But just for simplicity, let's say we assumed 1,000 of those 10,000 retirees would die, and then we received the data, and only 500 of them died. That means we have 9,500, whereas we thought we were going to have 9,000, and that would be a loss. And if we had more deaths than we expected, that, again, from the plan's perspective, that's a gain, because we have fewer people to pay out benefits because more people died. So it's a combination of factors. But salary increases would have no impact on the people who have already retired, because their benefits are fixed already, or they're known. The only things that could affect them are inflation or mortality.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Bynum.
Oh, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Back to slide 8 really quick, and I forgot to ask the question. You had mentioned in here that the healthcare trust is currently over 100% funded, but I didn't see in the slides anywhere where we said what our current funding rate was for the pension. So if you have that available, that'd be just handy for the slide for information purposes. But could you, ultimately my question is, can you describe to us why we're in a condition where our healthcare trust is well overfunded, but the retirement portion of the plan is what I'd consider well underfunded, given the fact that we have this liability that keeps getting pushed out?
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, the healthcare trust, and we're going to see the rates when we get to the next section. When we look at the FY26 contribution rates, you'll see the contribution rates for pension and healthcare. I'd say there's three key reasons why the healthcare trusts are overfunded. One is the Department of Retirement and Benefits implemented something called an EGWP, which is an employer group waiver program, which is essentially a subsidy that's received by the plan from the federal government based on the benefits that are provided to retirees. So that subsidy essentially is like an extra contribution to the trust, and that reduces liabilities because you're now receiving these EGWP subsidies. And that in total between PERS and TERS in 2018, that reduced the overall healthcare liabilities by almost about $1 billion in total, introducing EGWP. The other changes, the Department of Revenue and Benefits changed the plan administrators. A plan administrator, I believe that was in 2019, and perhaps because of increased efficiency of the payment of claims by the plan administrator, we saw a decrease in the amount of claims that were being paid out compared to what we had seen in prior years. And then we also saw for a couple of years, this most recent year was a reversal, but we saw for a couple of years, again, actual claims being paid out to retirees and their beneficiaries were lower than we thought they were going to be based on past experience, and that also contributed to healthcare gains. This last year, we saw that reverse for the first time in about 3 or 4 years, where actual claims paid out were more than we expected, which created a healthcare loss, but the healthcare trusts are still overfunded, like I said, largely because of EGWP that was implemented in 2018.
So follow-up?
Representative Bynum?
Is that an ongoing, that subsidy, is that ongoing year after year, or is that was that basically a one-time injection into the plan?
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, the Ag Whip is an ongoing assumption. Now, there are nobody knows if that federal program will stop at some point in the future, but there's every indication that it's going to be it's going to continue. Now, the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022 made some changes to the Ag Whip subsidies, and those changes were reflected, have been reflected in our liability calculations. But we are continuing to monitor the Ag Whip subsidies, but it is considered to be an ongoing subsidy received by the plan to reduce future liability, healthcare liabilities.
Thank you, Co-Chair. The reason I brought this up basically is because when we look at all of our other liabilities that we have, specifically when we reference health insurance, this has been one of the biggest impacts to our costs across the board, to not only state government but also to our municipal governments. They're funding our schools. The healthcare cost has went basically out of control. Or at least it feels that way. And so it seems a bit odd that in our retirement program that portion is very healthy, and the projection continues to say that it's going to be healthy and be funded well over 100%. And then just finally, did we have the percent funded currently on the plan?
Mr. Kirshner?
I do.
And I can get it later. We don't need it right now, if that's okay.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, as the most recent measurements were as of 6/30/24, the PERS healthcare trust was about 132% funded, and the TERS healthcare trust was about 139% funded, which means the existing assets exceed the liabilities. Now, keep in mind that's a snapshot measurement in time. That's subject to change every year, but at that point, based on our valuations, those are the most recent healthcare funded ratios.
Okay. So quick follow-up. What about for the PERS TERS fund itself, retirement portion, not the healthcare port?
Mr. Kirshner?
The healthcare?
Not the healthcare, the retirement trust.
For PERS and TERS?
Yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, the PERS pension funded ratio at 6/30/24 was 68%, and TERS pension was just under 78% funded.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And I don't see any further questions. The next section is the example FY26 additional state contributions. There's only four slides in that section. If folks have questions as we go along, feel free to wave your pen or something, and I'll keep a lookout there. So folks are, I think at the last round, everybody tried to get in line as quick as they could when I asked for questions, and we had four hands go up at the same time, everybody looking like they wanted to be first in line. So as we're going along, feel free to let me know. But we'll take that, and then we'll go to questions after we get through that section. So with that, Mr. Kirshner.
Okay. So I thought it would be helpful to show, again, the FY26 contribution rates were adopted by the Arm Board in September of 2024, and these are the rates that are going to go into effect on July 1 of this year. So I thought it would be helpful to walk through so you can see the mechanics of how these are calculated, and we go through the same calculation when we look at the HB 78 cost. It's the same mathematical calculation. So slide 12 are the contribution rates for the defined benefit plans. The first three columns are for PERS. And as I said earlier, we calculate these separately by pension and healthcare and then aggregate them in the end. And then the next three columns are for TERS. It's important to remember that because the statutes are expressed the 22% for PERS non-state employers and the 12.56% as percentage of total pay, all of these percentages are as a percentage of total pay. So it includes not just the pay of defined benefit members, but the pay of defined contribution retirement members as well, which as we go further and further in time, the payroll of the defined contribution members becomes the lion's share of the pay because we have fewer and fewer active members. So the, in line one, in section one, we show the normal cost rate. Again, this is the cost rate. Normal cost is the cost of benefits expected to accrue in the upcoming year. 1A is the total rate. And then we subtract the member rate. And again, these member the member rate here is the all of the, for PERS, the peace officer and firefighter contribution rates that I talked about earlier, plus the all other contribution rates times their pay divided by total pay, so it averages out to be 1.71. So the employer is paying toward normal cost 2.14% of pay for FY26 for pension, and health care is 1.97. There are no member contributions for health care benefits, so that's why 1B is zero for health care. And then we have the past service cost rate. And this rate is the sum of all of our amortization layer payments divided by total pay. So for PERS pension, that's 18.63%. For TERS pension, that's 21.12%. And again, it's zero for the healthcare trust because the healthcare trusts are overfunded. So then we add the employer rate from 1C to the past service rate from line 2 to get the actuarially determined rate. And then we add the pension and health care. So for PERS, the actuarially determined contribution rate for all benefits is 22.74% of pay, and for TERS it's 25.48% of pay. And then we have line 4, which is the actual adopted contribution rates. And for the last 3 years, the ARM board has decided to not contribute the health care normal cost because the health care trusts are overfunded, and so if we contribute the healthcare normal cost, it would just make them even more overfunded. So they've decided to not contribute the healthcare normal cost because of that, which helps the employer contribution is then dedicated more toward the pension trust. And then the second thing was, even though the ARM board adopted a layered amortization, for the last couple of years, they have elected to amortize or adopt a rate based on the original 25-year period that was set up in 2014, rather than which just, like I said, accelerates more contributions into the earlier year. So if you look at the ARM board adopted rate for PERS pension, it was 21.43 versus 20.77, and then, like I said, the healthcare rate is zero. So that's the rates for the defined benefit plan. Then the next two slides are basically the same information for the DCR, the defined contribution retirement plans. These are the costs that are for employees hired on or after June of 2006. We've got four different benefits. We have the occupational death and disability, the retiree medical or health care, the defined contribution employer contribution, which is, as I said, for PERS is 5%, for TERS it's 7%, and then the 3% health reimbursement account contribution. We don't the actuarially rate for the past service cost rate for occupational death and disability and retired medical is zero because those trusts are also overfunded. And, of course, there's no past service rate for the defined contribution and health reimbursement because those are just fixed percentages. So then we in line three, we add the two components, and then we divide by pay for DCR members, and then we do a projection. But basically, in line seven, we're converting the DCR rates to a percentage of total pay, just like the DB rates are expressed as a percentage of total pay. So if you look at in the bottom right corner, the total employer rate for PERS defined contribution retirement members as a percentage of total pay is 6.9%. And then on the next page, we do the same thing for TERS DCR, and that is 7.65% of pay. Then on slide 15, we bring it all together. So on slide 15, we show the calculation for PERS and TERS separately. Line 1 are the defined benefit rates. Those came directly from slide 12. Then we have the defined contribution retirement rate on line two. Those come from slide 13 and 14 that we just went through. We add those together to get the total rate in line three. So for PERS, it's 28.33 and TERS, 31.33. Then we compare those to the statutory employer rate. For PERS, non-state employers, it's 22%. And for TERS, it's 12.56. So the excess rate, which is paid by the state, is in line 5A. That's just the total rate from line 3 minus the statutory rate in line 4. And then in line 5B, we make an adjustment for interest because the rates in lines 1 and 2 reflect the fact that employer and member contributions are paid throughout the year, every payroll period, whereas additional state contributions are generally paid at the beginning of the fiscal year. So there's an extra half year of interest earned on the additional state contributions. So that's what line 5B is doing, is adjusting for that half year of interest. And then we multiply by projected pay in line 6, and then we get the dollar amount of the additional state contributions. So for the year beginning July 1, 2025, the PERS additional state contribution for non-state employers is $79.8 million, and for TERS, just under $139 million.
Great. Thank you. For finance members, there's going to be a quiz after we get this presentation, so I hope everyone's really paying attention. This is good stuff. I feel like we're going to be real experts at the end of this, Representative Galvin. Representative Kelly, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Coach Foster, through this chair. The question goes back to slide 12. My question is regarding, so we can see that the adopted contribution rate is at 21.43%, and I'm curious to know if you know how long it is projected by Gallagher for the pension then to be fully funded for PERS, TERS at that rate, if that, I think you had it at 2039 at one point, but I didn't know if that incorporated this number or how that works out.
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, the 21.43 that was adopted reflects the original 25-year period that expires in 2039. The 22.74 in line 3 is based on the layered amortizations that is projecting 2048.
With your extra data that you have, that's where you got to the 22.74 now.
Well, those are the layered amortization. That's based on the layered amortization approach. So if the ARM board were to continue adopting rates based on line 4, then we would expect the pension trust to be fully funded by 2039 if they continue to do that.
Okay, so at 2039. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, and next question, Representative Stout.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. Okay, so first on not adopting the layered amortization. So help me kind of square that circle. So in my mind, because the assumptions are basically getting worse than what we thought, if I don't incorporate my layered amortization, I'm basically kicking my liability payments out later and having to pay more later. But I'm listening to you, and it sounds like maybe I'm wrong. So help me understand that through the chair.
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, it's actually the opposite. The layered amortization extends when we're expected to reach fully funding because the unfunded liability that was created in 2024, for example, is going to be funded through 2048. That's 25 years, starting in 2024. And then similarly, when we do the 2025 valuation, the layer created in 2025 will then be funded through 2049, 25 years. Mm-hmm. So what the ARM board actually adopted in line 4 was pretending that we never implemented layered amortization, so that we continued with the fixed period that was going to end in 2039. So what that actually does is it contributes more now and less later because they're pushing the funding into the next 14 or 15 years, however many years is left.
Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow up.
Okay, so basically, now I understand that. So are they just incorporating the losses then from the plan into our state contribution, and that's why our state contributions are going up if they're not going to reamortize the cost? Because they are absorbing the losses of the projected of the plan, right? And they're taking that out in additional state contribution in order to keep that liability paid off by 2039. Because if they didn't change, because clearly we were, you know, we're losing where we were at, or at least projected we were thought. So if we take the additional costs and the changes assumptions, is that what's driving the additional state contribution so high then, through the chair?
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. It's like as if you had a 30-year mortgage payment, and every year you made an extra mortgage payment to pay down your mortgage faster. That's essentially what they've done here. So they're making an extra payment by assuming the layered amortization, which goes out to 2048. They're saying let's fund it as if we're still on schedule to pay it down by 2039. So it's like paying an extra mortgage payment every year. Your mortgage just gets paid down faster. And so therefore the amount goes up.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow up.
So in your expertise, I know you do this a lot, the disparity between our basically total employer contribution for our pension and basically what we give our current employees under our DCR plan, I mean, is that like a standard split to see that level of disparity? Because, you know, at this committee, we have a bunch of folks who work for state government that are in our Tier 4 system, and they talk about how their current system is inadequate. And when you see that their current system, they're only getting 6.9% total contribution rate, it's kind of hard not to agree with them, I'd imagine. So is that a standard kind of thing that you see when you look at how these plans are in terms of employer-employer contributions through the chair?
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. It depends on the nature of the benefits, and we're actually going to see when we look at the HB 78 slides, we're going to see that the HB 78, the benefits that HB 78 members would receive, which is a lifetime pension with post-retirement pension adjustments, et cetera, those are more valuable benefits than they're currently receiving as a member of the defined contribution plan, and therefore they're more costly. Mm-hmm. So, yes, the defined benefit the cost for defined benefit members are more than they are for defined contribution members because the benefits are more valuable and therefore there's a higher cost.
Yeah. Follow up, Mr. Kocher.
Follow up.
Yeah. You know, that makes sense. You know, I mean, obviously the better the benefit, the higher the price, right? Last one is just on these two slides, 13 and 14. My assumption is you're not incorporating the other thing we have for these, most of these folks, are supplemental benefit system at all in these slides, correct? SBS, through the chair.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Stapp, that's correct. SBS is completely outside of these calculations.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay, any further questions? Seeing Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster. You mentioned that defined benefits is more or better after retirement. How do you justify that? I mean, with a defined contribution plan, I get to keep my principal. I get to, when I pass away, I get to give that principal off to my children, and I get the same benefit if you take a certain percentage each year, draw on your principal on a defined contribution. I mean, you can be getting the same amount of money as you could with a defined benefit. The only difference is I own that principal and that's mine to keep. So I don't understand how you said the defined benefit contribution or plan is better than the defined contribution.
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, I hope I pronounced that right. Well, it depends because in a defined contribution plan, the investment risk sits with the individual members. And so their benefits could actually be more than what we're projecting if they earn more than what we're assuming, which is 7.25%. On the other hand, I know my 401k account has suffered the last month because we've lost money on our 401k. So just like 401k or 403b benefits, the benefits that defined contribution members receive will be a function of what they earn on those accounts. Whereas in the defined benefit plan, it's a fixed guaranteed benefit based on level of years of service and pay at retirement. But that's a lifetime benefit that usually has survivor benefits attached to it. So if a member dies before they receive all their benefits, there can be a survivor benefit payable to the beneficiary for the remainder of that beneficiary's life. There's also the post-retirement pension adjustments that defined benefit members get. That's a very valuable benefit, and it's costly, an automatic inflation-adjusted benefit, particularly in an era of high inflation. So it really depends, but based on the level of benefits that we have here, defined benefit versus defined contribution, the costs are higher for defined benefit because they're more valuable. If we were to change the employer contribution from 5% to, say, 10%, then we would have a different story because they'd be getting much, much more money from the employer. But based on these level of benefits and our assumptions, the defined benefit plans are benefits are more valuable and therefore more costly.
Well, follow up. I guess it depends on your point of view and how you've invested it, right? Like you stated, and I do appreciate your comments on that. And the survivor benefits, you're going to be going through SB or HB 78 and all the benefits that's going to be. Are we doing that next?
Yes, that's coming up in the next few slides.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, in the lineup, I've got Representative Bynum, Allard, and Galvin. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I just wanted to clarify a few things that I thought I heard and see how it was characterized and make sure I understand it. You talked about that the defined benefit plan was more valuable, therefore it would cost more money. And I'm assuming that when we get into examples here a little bit later, that comment is based on the fact that we're not comparing apples to apples here. We're not talking about the equal amounts of money going into something and then finding the value of it. We're characterizing the DB as under 78 of having a higher value, but it's going to cost more to get that same value. Is that accurate?
Mr. Krishner?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, we determine the projected cost based on a series of assumptions that, and we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. But based on our assumptions and the level of benefits, we have determined that the benefits that HB 78 members would receive as a member of the defined benefit plan would cost more than what they currently cost, which is what's shown here on slide 13 and 14. That's correct.
And then one of the things that was also mentioned was talking about when we look at the defined contribution plan, that market volatility impacts that plan depending on when you're going to try to draw or retire from it and how your money is invested. And those are obviously, we could have a whole presentation on talking about defined contribution investment strategies and what kind of fund you have your money in and how that has a return. But when we were also looking at the DB plan earlier, we did look at the market volatility does have impacts to the DB plan. And under the previous PERS programs that we had, the employee was not impacted by that. It's only the liability that gets impacted by that. But under 78, my understanding is that we're talking about shared risk. So there is a possibility that market volatility does have a negative impact to both the three participants in that, which would be the employee, the retiree, and the employer. Is that accurate?
Mr. Krishner?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, in a defined benefit plan, the investment risk is borne entirely by the plan sponsor. And in this case, that's a combination of employers and the state. Now, if we didn't have our 22% or 12.56% statutory contribution limits, then if our investment earnings don't meet our expectations, then the employers would pay more. Now, because we have those caps, the state pays more. But similarly, when we earn more than our assumed return, the contribution rates come down because we earn more than we thought we were going to earn. The members themselves are totally unaffected in terms of their cost by in a defined benefit plan. It's investment risk, and vice versa. In a defined contribution environment, the investment risk is borne 100% by the members.
Sure. As a quick follow-up, my understanding is, obviously, under the current PERS 1-2-3 model, that's true, that the employee or the retiree is not going to be impacted by those volatilities. But my understanding of the way that HB 78, the bill that we're hearing, which we will be talking about some of those comparables a little bit later, is a shared risk model, and that does impact not just the employer. And I'm taking away the 22% cap at this point under the assumptions. We know that that exists, and that then liability then shifts to the state when that goes beyond the 22%. But my understanding of HB 78 is that it's a shared risk plan, and the employee does share in the risk on that. Is that not accurate?
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Biner, no, that's accurate. We're going to talk about that in our projections, which assume that all future experience matches our assumptions. None of those risk-sharing provisions would be triggered. But you're right, HB 78 has built into it two risk-sharing provisions. One is that the ARM board can reduce the post-retirement pension adjustments that HB 78 members receive. They can also increase the member contribution rate, which is 8%. They can increase it to as high as 12% if the funds were to dip below a certain level. Now, based on our projections the assumptions that we've used, we are not projecting the funds to dip below those levels, so those triggers would not be met. But you're right. The way HB 78 is designed is it does have some of those risk-sharing provisions built in case we have adverse experience in the future that affects the unfunded liabilities for HB 78 members. Those provisions would kick in.
Can I ask a clarifying question?
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So in my mind, when I hear the word shared risk, I guess I naturally go to the idea of being equal risk. But what I'm hearing you saying is that it isn't necessarily equal risk, where we all equally take a potential risk in this, where when there's needed funding, that we all are contributing to that. What I'm hearing you saying is that there's tiered risk. So first risk goes on to the state, in this case, because there's limitations put in place with the 22%. There potentially could be risk put on to the retirees, depending on what the ARM board decides, and then also potential risk going to the employee, depending on where those dollars go. But it isn't necessarily that when there's a dip in needing for additional funds that equally gets shared. It's based on trigger points. Is that accurate?
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, that's correct. So the trigger is 90%. So if the funded levels, we're sort of getting ahead of ourselves talking about HB 78, but if the funded levels of the HB 78 trusts for HB 78 members dips below 90%, then those triggers would be activated and the ARM board could adjust both employee member contributions for HB 78 members and reduce the post-retirement pension adjustments. But, for example, if the funded status, which is starting out at 100%, if that dips to, say, 95% because of some future adverse experience, that would be borne entirely by the employers in the state because those triggers would not be activated if we only fall below to 95%.
Thank you. Co-Chair Foster, I was just trying to clarify that when there's market volatility, depending on whether you're in a legacy PERS plan or looking at a future PERS plan, that market volatility does provide a risk to somebody. And in this case, it could be shared risk. But under the defined contribution plan, it's potentially a risk to the employee. So just trying to clarify what we were talking about. Thank you.
I've got a lineup. Representative Josephson, do you have a on this?
Yes, but stick to your line.
Okay.
Thank you.
Also, I just want to do a time check. We're an hour and a half in. We're going till 3:30. I'm available to stay longer, so I've got no problems, but I want to make sure that everyone else is also able to stay longer if they would like to be able to hear everything. And if we go over 3:30, is there anyone who, I guess, can't be here who would like to be able to get to the, I guess, the real guts of the matter, in which case we may need to speed up a little bit, or if no one has any issues, then we could kind of take our time and go as long as we want, another hour if we need to. But I believe Mr. Kirshner has to fly out tonight, so I just want to let folks know that we do have some time constraints. Mr. Kirshner, did you have a comment before I jump right into some other announcements?
I have a 6:30 flight, so I've got some time, probably more time than you guys have.
Okay, great. Okay, well, I'm not seeing anyone saying that they can't stay longer. Representative Pannon?
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I do have two constituent appointments scheduled that I've told staff I would personally handle, so I may step out and then come back.
Okay, great. Okay, well, if folks are okay, if we need to go over, I'm fine with asking as many questions as we want. We do have some folks who may need to step out for hearings as well. We do have 38 slides. We're on slide, I think, 15. We just got done with that, so maybe we're on slide 16 now. So the next couple sections, and I do have three more questions to line up here before we move on, but the next couple sections we do have, there are only two slides. I think the next four sections, there are only two slides each, so... with that in the lineup, I've got Representative Allard, Galvin, and Josephson. Representative Allard.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So one of my questions was Representative Tomaszewski just brought it up, and it was in regards to I think it was the contributions or the retirement plan will go on to their spouse or to perhaps a child that is under, like, state care and is disabled of some sort. So I'm going to ask you a couple questions, and maybe you know. Do you know at the average age of Alaska State employees' retirement age?
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, it differs by level of benefits, a level of group, because of the nature of the benefits. So we tend to see earliest retirements among the peace officers and firefighters within PERS, because they tend to have more subsidized early retirement benefits because of the nature of their profession. So, for example, a peace officer and firefighter can retire at any age with at least 20 years of service, whereas a non-peace officer firefighter with PERS can only retire after 30 years of service. So we tend to see earlier retirements for peace officers and firefighters. And recently, we have seen even fewer retirements among the teachers. We've seen many teachers continue to work into their 70s, perhaps because, I don't want to surmise why we've seen that. But we do see experience that tends to see earliest retirements at the youngest ages for the peace officers and firefighters. And then the more delayed retirements we typically see for the teachers.
Okay. And then do you also know, may I, co-chair?
Thank
you.
Ballard?
Do you know the average age of individuals in Alaska's life expectancy?
Through the chair, Representative Allard,
how long would we be paying peace officer, you're looking, maybe they want to retire between the ages of 40, 40, 41, 45, if they came on board at 21.
Yeah, well, we don't see too many retirements that early, but for example, if a peace officer and firefighter retired at age 50,
okay,
we would probably expect a life expectancy of probably 30 years at that point, based on
80?
Through age 80, for example.
Okay, I would say 74, 75. Isn't that the average lifespan of a...
Yeah, but when the life... that's at birth. So once you've made it to age 50, you've got longer life expectancy because you've already made it to age 50. So, for example, the life expectancy of a 50-year-old might be, let's say it's 30 years to age 80, whereas at 65, the life expectancy might be through age 83, because you've now made it from 50 to 55 to 65, so we don't have to discount the possibility that you're not going to survive until 65.
Okay.
So the life expectancy varies, 80? But generally for a 65-year-old, I think we can probably estimate life expectancy for a male 65-year-old is probably about 17 or 18 years, and maybe 19 or 20 years for a female,
okay,
age 65, based on the mortality assumption.
So if, Co-Chair, thank you. So if the spouse, if the person's married and the spouse survives, the benefits then go to the spouse, correct? Is there a form or something they have to fill out? I'm doing this on public record for a reason.
Through the chair, Representative Ballard, it depends. If a member, when they retire in the defined benefit plan, they have the option of selecting a variety of forms of benefits. So the normal form of benefit is a single life annuity that gets paid to them for as long as they live. And then upon their death, that's it. Nothing else is paid. Or they can elect a joint and survivor benefit, which pays them a certain amount as long as they live, and upon their death, a certain percentage continues to their beneficiary. So it depends on what the individual retiree elects when they retire, whether there's a survivor benefit or not. It's up to them.
I'm going to do a couple if that's okay, since we're going to. So if I had defined benefits and I passed away, and my husband isn't longer alive either, are you saying that I could designate anybody I want to get a portion of my defined benefits to include my children?
Through the chair, I'm actually going to defer answering that. I'd rather have someone from the department who knows the actual forms, because there might be restrictions on children, for example, and there's sometimes restrictions on age difference.
Okay.
So I can't answer that specifically.
Here's my favorite, Ms. Leah. Hello.
Sure.
Ms. Lee, if you could put yourself on the record.
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm Kathy Lee. I'm the director of the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And through the chair, Representative Allard, you can, in the defined benefit plans, you can only designate a child as a survivor if they are totally incapacitated.
Okay.
And the spouse has to waive their rights to that benefit,
okay,
in order to do so. So in your example, if you were to die and then your spouse was already deceased, but you had chosen a joint and survivor option, then all your beneficiaries would receive is your last paycheck or any balance in your contribution account that you paid in at that time.
Now I'm going to go for a clarification, if you don't mind. So is that for a child that is completely disabled, or is that for any child? I just want to make sure I heard you correctly. You said if I decided to, if my spouse was gone and I designated, is that only for a disabled child or fully incapacitated?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, yes. The child has to be totally incapacitated and unable to support themselves.
On defined contributions, I've had two examples. I've had state employees walk up to me in this building and thank me for asking certain questions because their mother had passed and they received nothing. And the mother passed within 2 years of retiring. And I said, that's terrible. And she said, yes. And all the money went back to the state. Who gets the money if the person deceased doesn't get the money, the state gets the money back, correct?
Ms. Lee?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, if the mother was unmarried,
mm-hmm,
and had not yet retired, so she has an intact contribution account that she...
She did retire.
She did retire.
Yes.
Okay, well, if a member retires, benefits that they receive are paid first from their contribution account.
Mm-hmm.
So within about 2 years, they have exhausted their contribution account. What pays them for the rest of their lifetime is the employer contributions and the earnings on the fund. So if she had been retired mm-hmm. and had exhausted her contributions, then there would be only the last check
okay.
for the beneficiaries.
I apologize. I'm going to do a little clarification. So on defined benefits, she had that. She passed away within 2 years of retiring. She had plenty of money, but she died. So what happens to say she had $900,000 worth in her account? What happened to the $900,000? If she passes away, it goes to nobody. It goes back to the state, right? I mean, we just don't leave it in her bank account. You don't dole it out anymore. So what happens to all that money?
Ms. Lee?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, it would be highly unusual for a PERS member to have $900,000 in their account if they had been retired for at least 2 years, because $900,000 exceeds the average amount that we see in participant accounts. So it's possible that the constituent was talking about a different plan. That is something I might see in the SBS plan. But regardless, once a participant dies, the remaining assets they have in the plan are paid out to either their survivor or their beneficiaries. And the only way no one would get anything mm-hmm. is if there was no beneficiary designation on file. Then they would have to go to court.
Okay. So maybe I'm not clarifying. What happens to the money? So if I am retired and I've been retired for 2 days, to say, and my benefits kick in, I don't have a spouse, and I'm on defined benefits, I don't have children who are incapacitated, what happens to all my retirement money? I know for a fact in defined benefits, I have someone, our defined contributions, they're literally getting the inheritance, which is almost $1 million, and he was able to pass it down to his 70-year-old daughter, who is now going to pass it down to their grandchildren. If I retire, what happens to all my money if I have nobody to inherit it? Does it go back to the state?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, it does not go to the state.
Who does it go to?
It goes back to the trust.
So it goes back to the trust, which mm-hmm. the state owns?
No, the state
who owns
does
it?
Not own. The members in the trust.
But whose money is it? Is it the state's money that they're putting into the trust? I mean, you get defined benefits, and this is why we have a bill in front of us, right?
Ms. Lee?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, anything that is remaining in the employee's contribution account mm-hmm. at the time of death, if they have no survivor, no beneficiaries, mm-hmm. reverts to the PERS or TERS trusts, depending on which one they're in. The money does not go back to the state. The state cannot access the money.
Well, somebody's paying for it, and it's the taxpayers in the state of Alaska. But let's skip that portion. Let's go back to defined contributions, may I?
Representative Allard.
So with defined contributions, if I pay into defined contributions and my husband is deceased, do my children get my defined contributions? Say I have $900,000 in my defined contributions. Do my children inherit that fund?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, in the defined contribution account, you can leave your money to whomever you choose. So we would expect that there would be a beneficiary designation on file directing who you would be sending or how we should apportion your account. If there is none, it goes first to your spouse. If there's no spouse, then it goes to your children. And if there's no children, it goes to your parents.
So it can go all the way down until the money is gone.
Ms. Lee, I'm wondering, in terms of your availability, I just want to make sure that we're taking advantage of Mr. Kirshner's being here before he has to fly out and getting the actuary to us.
I'll stop.
Before he, okay.
May I?
We can have you come
you,
back,
Ms.
Lee. Representative Allard?
My point is, when you have defined benefits, it stops at your spouse or if you have an incapacitated child. There are so many people that I know who've had defined benefits that their spouse is not available, meaning they have deceased or they don't have any children or their children aren't incapacitated. That's it. So all their money that they've worked so hard for has no longevity with their family. what happens with defined contributions is if I pass away and my spouse isn't around, it goes down to my children until all my money is gone. Otherwise, it does go back to the state in a trust, and it is not used, and it does belong to the state and the taxpayers. So I'm just struggling on why defined benefits is better for the person and not defined contributions. Now, maybe defined benefits might save the state money, but does it really? Because if you're saying people are going to retire at a certain age, we're still going to be paying for 30 years on, and it doesn't really help their family in the future. I would think that defined benefits needs to be more of an investment for their offspring and for their spouses, and I just don't see that with the defined benefits.
And Ms. Lee, are you available tomorrow at 1:30 for our next finance meeting tomorrow?
Yes, I would be.
Okay. I could give her the questions ahead of time, too.
Okay. Yeah. That'd be great. Yeah. If we could maybe, if you're available, we could have you come back. I have a feeling that there are some some things that we're hoping to get to that we may have to push off to tomorrow's. I'm hoping we can get through at least the actuary here, but we do need to adopt the CS. I know we're going to be missing a bunch of people, so we might have to push off some of the things we wanted to tomorrow's meeting here. So with that, thank you very much, Ms. Lee. Mr. Kirshner, Representative Allard, do you have any other questions for Mr. Kirshner before we move to Representative Galvin?
I appreciate your patience, and yes, I will stick to what we're here with, and I'll address the others with Ms. Lee. Thank you, Mr. Kirshner. Thank you, Co-Chair.
Thank you. Representative Galvin.
Thank you. I think I'm going to hold off until page 28 because a lot of that is it's all about my questions were related to survival benefit and the post-retirement inflation adjustment pieces. So I see that's addressed later, and I want to please allow us to get through this. Thank you.
Great, thank you. And I know that we've got a couple of folks. I've gotten some notes. Folks have bill hearings. We've got somebody who's asking if we could maybe do a hard stop at 3:55. So we're going to be losing some folks here pretty soon. So I've just we've got one more question, then we'll go back to Mr. Kirshner and the slide deck. So with that, Representative Josephson, question?
Yes, and I'm going to be as concise as I can be. Through the chair, Mr. Kirshner, welcome. One of the things you said that struck me, and this was a good now 15 minutes ago or more, but you said that you first noted that the risk in House Bill 78 was borne by the state. And then, and I mean this with great respect, I'm enjoying your testimony, but Representative Bynum said, but isn't the plan actually a shared risk? And you said that, and indeed it was a shared risk, including present workers and retirees. But you said something very compelling. You said it's unlikely that the risk will be shared because the funds won't dip beneath basically the 90% solvent levels. And that struck me as vitally important and actually arguably the key to the bill from those of us who like the bill. And we'll get to this, I know. But were you indicating that the bill is written in such a way that with triggers and sort of responsible, responsible policies that by, for example, not affording a generous health plan in a DB fashion, but more in the HRA, et cetera, that it's unlikely that those sorts of triggers will even be needed. Is that what I heard you say?
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, our projections, all of our projections, as we're going to talk about in a minute, assume that future experience matches our assumptions. And under that set of assumptions, we are not projecting the HB 70 subtrust to come anywhere near 90%. They're starting out at 100 and they're well above 90%. Could events occur? For example, could we have a terrible year in the markets where assets decline by such a percentage that the 90% threshold could be triggered? Yes, that could happen. Is it likely? Probably not, but as we're going to talk about in a minute, we would suggest that, you know, we could do an analysis under varying different scenarios, just like we do every year for the ARM board, where we provide sensitivity analysis that says, well, let's say we have 3 years where we have three successive bad years of asset returns, and then we recover back to the 7.25. What impact does that have? And for the defined benefit plans, that has a huge impact, could have a huge impact to the state. Now, if we were to run a similar scenario like that, if that would cause this, the funded levels of the HB 78 subtrust to fall below 90%, then all of that risk wouldn't fall directly to the state. Some of it would be borne by the members because the ARM board has the authority under the provisions of HB 78 to increase the member contributions from 8% to as high as 12%. But it may not eliminate the entire adverse effect. So there still could be impact to the state. But by moving members in back into the defined benefit, when the defined benefit plans were closed in 2006, the state was essentially mitigating some of their future risks because by putting the post-2006 members in a defined contribution environment, that shifts the risk to the participant. Putting them back into a defined benefit environment brings some of that risk back. And some of it is controlled by the risk-sharing provisions, but it's not completely eliminated.
Mm-hmm. And just a quick follow-up.
Representative Josephson.
Maybe this is a sneak preview, but am I right that one of the things we're going to find about the cost to the state, potential cost, in House Bill 78 relates to its effectiveness? That is, you anticipate, as did the other actuary, Chiron, that it will have the desired effect. And that is, for example, we have a supplemental nutrition program, food stamp program, and we have eligibility technicians. We couldn't hire enough or employ enough. And as a consequence, we're paying a $12 million penalty to the federal government. We just have to pay as cash. And is it your understanding, and are we going to see that in the final analysis, it's going to be easier to hire people in a tier five because, as you said, the retirement is more attractive than in tier four? Is that what we're going to see?
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, our expectation, I think the general understanding, everyone, I think, expects if HB 78 or something like it that puts people into the defined benefit plan, that's going to help future retention. It's going to lower future turnover, and because people are going to be incentivized to stay to receive their retirement benefits in a defined benefit environment. And we agree with that. And our assumptions, which we're going to talk about in a minute, are consistent with that general expectation. But that means that we're expecting more people will be around as an HB 78 member than we're currently assuming as a defined contribution retirement member. More members in the future means more benefits, which means more liabilities, which means more contributions. So they're all tied together. But yes, we would expect, consistent with the general expectation of higher retention going forward, that we will therefore have higher costs. Now, we're going to talk about this in a minute, but all of our analysis is strictly focused on the actuarial impact to the state contributions. It doesn't include the potential economic benefit to the state from all these other things like lower training costs and lower recruiting costs. That has to be considered and then combined with our analysis to look at the sort of the expected totality of the economic benefit to the state. Our analysis is strictly restricted to the potential actuarial impact on future contributions to PERS and TERS.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. The time now is 3:25. We'll have a hard stop at 3:55. We're on slide 17. I think the crux of the presentation looks to me like it might be slides 26 through 36. And so maybe if we could hold questions till the end, and then if we need to bring Mr. Kirshner back for follow-up questions, we could maybe do that via teleconference if we need to. Just so we can get this out on the record tonight before he flies out. So with that, Mr. Kirshner, if you'd like to proceed.
All right. Thank you. The next few slides, the actual assumptions, we've actually talked a lot about those through the questions, so I'll go through them very quickly. On slide 17, Alaska statutes require that we analyze experience of the plans every four years and through an experience study. And what an experience study does is it says, okay, we've got these assumptions that were last set in 2022, so our next experience study would be next year, and new assumptions go into effect in 2026. So what we do in an experience study is every 4 years, we look and say, okay, what actually happened over the last 4 years, and how did that compare with what our current assumptions we're predicting, and should we modify those assumptions based on recent experience? Now, recent experience has to be evaluated somewhat subjectively. For example, when we were in the COVID years, we saw very low termination rates. We also saw somewhat lower salary increase rates. So if we're looking at experience that covers, for example, the COVID years, we don't necessarily want to assume that the low turnover the last couple of years is going to be indicative of the future. So the analogy I would say is when you're driving a car, you glance in the rearview mirror once in a while, but you're really focused on driving forward. So while we are looking at past experience, our focus is on the long term. Now, Alaska statutes do require that the health, even though we do an experience analysis once every 4 years, that we are required to review the healthcare assumptions annually. So our health actuary, as part of the annual evaluations, analyzes the healthcare costs, which are expressed on a per capita basis, and the trend rates, which are the assumed increases of those costs going forward. Those are reviewed annually. As actuaries, we have a series of what we call actuarial standards of practice that govern the provision of services that we provide to our clients. And regarding assumptions, we are required to use assumptions that reflect our quote-unquote best estimate of reasonable long-term experience. So one of the things that I know is has been debated is what the termination rates we should be assuming for the HB 78 members. And it is our belief, consistent with the fact that we're expecting higher retention going forward, that we should not be assuming the same high termination rates that have currently been seen for the defined contribution members if they're going to be in a defined benefit plan that provides them more incentive to stick around. So lower retention means fewer terminations, and that's consistent with our assumptions. And the other thing to remember is there's no right or wrong answer with assumptions. I mean, if you're using an assumption that's unreasonable, for example, if we were assuming a return assumption of 12%, that would be considered unreasonable. But we could use we're using 7.25. It could be argued that 7% or 6.75 is also within a range of reasonableness. So we need to pick assumptions that are within a reasonable range. There's no single right answer for any particular assumption. As I said, the current assumptions were set based on the most recent 4 years of experience that went through 2021. And in some prior committee meetings, I've heard some questions about whether we're using the experience of Alaska's members. And yes, we are. We are analyzing the turnover, the retirement patterns, the mortality of Alaska plan participants in setting the assumptions. Now, with regard to mortality, we have standardized mortality tables that are based on hundreds and hundreds of thousands of lives and deaths. So you may not have perfectly statistically credible data based on your own plan experience for certain assumptions, but to the extent that the data is credible, we are using Alaska-specific experience to set the assumptions. So moving on to slide 20, as I said, we are using the current assumptions that we're using for the actual evaluations, except we are blending the retirement rates to be 75% of the defined contribution retirement rates and 25% of the defined benefit retirement rates, and that's consistent with sections 4 and 60 of the text of HB 78 that state that the HB 78 provisions must be based on the most recent assumptions used in the most recent valuation, except for the blended retirement rates. We've noted in our March 24th fiscal note letter that we don't know what the future termination experience of HB 78 members is likely to be. We do believe it's more likely to be closer to what the current defined benefit members' termination experience has been, except those termination rates were, some of those termination rates were set many years ago when we had more active members in the defined benefit plan. So we will, over time, we will be able to analyze, if HB 78 were to pass, we will be able to analyze the actual turnover experience of HB 78 members, and we will therefore, once we get credible experience, we'll develop assumptions that are specific to those members once we have experience that we can evaluate. We talked about some of the HB 78 risk sharing provisions. Depending on the funded status of the HB 78 subtrust, as I said earlier, based on our assumptions that future experience is going to match our assumptions, those triggers would not be activated. So we haven't ignored them. They're just not triggered. They would not be triggered based on our assumption scenarios. If we were to use assumptions that were created adverse experience that we fell below 90%, then we would reflect a potential increase in the HB 78 member contribution rate and or a possible reduction in the post-retirement pension adjustments. And then, as I said earlier, the potential economic benefit to the state outside of the funding of PERS and TERS has to be considered when looking at our cost projections, to consider the potential, the total economic benefit to the state if HB 78 were to pass. So those are my comments on assumptions, and if there are no questions, we'll dive into some of the HB 78 numbers.
I was hoping that we could maybe hold questions till the end. Is it an involved question, Representative Bynum? Okay, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Really quick, you talked about using the assumption of basically old DB rates instead of something different. Wouldn't it have been more conservative for us to use some kind of a blend of more modern rates based on maybe the cutoff between DB and DC plan to kind of model about the rates around that time as opposed to the old DB and what kind of rates we were using way back then, because it is a different plan with different benefit. Wouldn't that have been a more conservative approach in trying to get our evaluation done?
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, yes, we definitely could have, and had we used termination rates that were somewhere in between, then our cost estimates would be lower than what we have projected. But yes, you could definitely use a different set of assumptions, and that would produce different results.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Kirshner?
All right. So now the information on the remaining slides comes directly from our March 24th fiscal note letter. So on slide 26 and 27, we have summarized the potential impact to the state contributions. Slide 26 are the additional state contributions, and slide 27 are the state as an employer contributions under PERS. Keep in mind that we have assumed in doing these calculations that 100%, let me take a step back, under HB 78, active members in the defined contribution plan will have the option to stay where they are or transfer to the defined benefit plan. We have assumed that 100% will elect to transfer to the defined benefit plan in our calculations. So to the extent that some active members elect to stay where they are, these cost estimates would be lower based on whatever those elections are. But we've modeled sort of I wouldn't say worst case, because we could potentially see higher costs, but worst case scenario from that perspective, in the sense that we've assumed that everyone who is not yet retired in the defined contribution plan will elect to transfer to the defined benefit plan. So on slide 26, the first three columns are the additional state contributions for the non-state employers under PERS, and we've shown through FY39. The first year we're showing here is fiscal year 27, and that's because even though HB 78 would be effective 7/1/25, the contribution rates for fiscal year 26 have already been adopted by the Armed Board, as we went through earlier. So the first year that contributions would be effective would be fiscal year 27. So the figures here are just our current baseline projections of additional state contributions for PERS, and then the next column is if HB 78 were to be enacted and all members elect to transfer, and based on our assumptions, we project the higher figures in HB 78. In a couple of slides, we're going to look and we're going to see how we chose FY30 as an example. So we're going to see how the figures in the 2030 row were derived in a couple of minutes. Then the next three columns are the same information for TERS. And then the last three columns are the combination of the PERS and TERS additional state contributions. So we're essentially projecting the potential impact of HB 78 based on our stated assumptions. Additional state contributions could increase by as much as $467 million through FY39. Then on slide 27, we have essentially the same information, but these are the state as an employer contributions under PERS. And again, they pay the full rate. So we show the current state as an employer contributions for the defined benefit plan and what those would be under HB 78. Then the middle three columns are the projected contributions for the defined contribution retirement plan current. The HB 78 column is the projected contribution rate for the current. There's a handful of people who have already retired in the defined contribution plan, and they would stay where they are, and they'll continue to receive their defined contribution benefits. The actual rate for those remaining retirees, because the DCR trusts are overfunded, that rate would actually be zero in our projections. So the DCR costs under the HB 78 column are the health reimbursement account contributions, the 4% for PERS, peace officers, and firefighters, and 3% for everyone else. That's what the HB 78 column represents. So we would actually see a decrease in the DCR contributions, and then when we combine the increase for the DB with the decrease in the DCR, you see the increase in the last column on the right. So through FY39, we're projecting potentially $687 million for the state as an employer contributions. So I know the $64,000 question is why are state contributions projected to increase? So there's really two reasons. One is, we've talked a little bit about it already, is the underlying benefits that HB 78 members would receive are more valuable from an actuarial impact. Every individual has to, Representative Allard was mentioning earlier, some people might prefer defined contributions. So from their perspective, from an individual perspective, DCR, defined contribution benefits, may be more valuable. But from an actuarial perspective, provisions that HB 78 members would be entitled to receive would cost more actuarially than what they currently cost as a DCR member. So members of the DCR plan, we went through the FY26 contributions earlier. We have the members of the DCR plans currently receive occupational death and disability benefits, health care benefits. They receive an employer contribution to their defined contribution account, which is 5% of pay for PERS members and 7% of pay for TERS members. And then they also receive a 3% of pay contribution to their health reimbursement accounts. As a member of the defined benefit plan, the HB 78 members will receive a lifetime pension unless they elect to receive a survivor benefit attached to it when they retire. But The normal form would be a lifetime pension. They would be eligible to receive the same health care benefits that they're currently eligible as a defined contribution retirement member. They would also be eligible to receive, as a, under the defined benefit plan, death and disability benefits, which are better or more valuable than they than what they currently receive as a defined contribution retirement plan member. They would also be eligible for the inflation-linked post-retirement pension adjustments that's linked to the annual changes in the Anchorage CPI. And they would also continue to receive employer contributions to their health reimbursement accounts, which are 4% of pay for PERS Peace Fire members and 3% of pay for everyone else. So the underlying health care benefits are the same, would be the same for HB 78 members than they currently receive, but from an actuarial cost perspective, because we're projecting future retention to be better under HB 78, that means we're going to be projecting more people will be around to receive the health care benefits, so the actuarial cost for the same benefits are higher if they're a member of the HB 7, defined benefit plan versus defined contribution retirement plan. So the table at the bottom of slide 28 shows the current the projected costs for FY 30 as a percentage of the pay for each group. So the current DCR costs as a percentage of their own pay. Earlier, when we looked at the FY 26 DCR costs, those were converted to a total pay basis. The costs here are projected as a percentage just of the DCR members' pay. So for PERS DCR members, we are the current employer cost as a percentage of the PERS DCR pay is 9.17%, comprised of less than a percent for occupational death and disability and health care, and then 5% for defined contribution and 3% for the health reimbursement accounts. And then for TERS, that total is 10.74%. When we look at the next section on the right, we have what those projected costs are for the same members as a member of the defined benefit plan under HB 78. The pension costs are about, as a percentage of their pay, about 6.5%. That's net of the 8% member contributions. And then the health care costs are shown there, about 2% of pay. Again, those are higher than what they're currently because we're projecting more people will be around to receive the benefits. More people means more benefits being paid out. More benefits being paid out means more liabilities, which results in higher costs. And then the health reimbursement account, that's the 3.16 is the blended rate of 4% for peace officers and firefighters and 3% for all others. So if you look at the total column in both sections, you can see the HB 78 costs as a percentage of pay are higher. And that's what I was referring to earlier. The more valuable benefits cost more from an actuarial perspective. So that's the first reason. The second reason, and this is the distribution of the employer contribution that I was referring to earlier, because the employer contributions are fixed at 22% for non-state PERS employers and 12.56% for TERS, the actuarially determined contribution, which is already above those rates, means that the excess falls to the state by the additional state contributions. So if we increase that actuarial rate even higher than what it currently is, that increase is also going to fall to the state. And we're going to see that in a minute when we go through the example. So let's go through the example. We'll go through it for PERS. It's a similar example for TERS. So what we see here on slide 31, we have these two donut charts. The one on the left is expressing the current cost as a percentage of total payroll. In blue are the defined benefit cost for the current members in the defined benefit, and then in green is the cost for the DCR members. The cost for the DCR members are the ones that we saw on the previous slide but converted to a total pay basis. Because the previous slide, which was or on slide 29 for PERS was 9.17, and on slide 31 it's 7.67. That's because 7.67 is as a percentage of all pay, whereas 9.1% was as a percentage just of the DCR pay. So in total, the total cost currently, DB and DCR is 29.16% of total pay. When we go to the donut chart on the right, we have the cost for the defined benefit plan goes down, which I'll explain in a minute. We have the green is the cost for DCR, which is actually zero, so there's no green section here. And then the yellow is the cost for the HB 78 members. Again, if we go to slide 29, the cost for the PERS HB 78 members was 11.78% of pay, of their pay. And then when we convert that 11.78% to total pay, it becomes 10.09%. So when we add up the 20.13 for the defined benefit, zero for defined contribution, and 10.09 for HB 78, the total cost increased to 30.22%. So now let's talk about who pays and where these cost increases fall. And this is, hopefully will crystallize to the extent that you're still following the numbers. So the first thing we look at is because all of our contribution rates are expressed as a percentage of total pay, we are showing what the projected payroll is expected to be for PERS members in FY30. It's projected to increase, and the reason is because we are expecting higher retention, we're anticipating fewer terminations, so we're going to have more people that of our current group of people that are expected to be around in FY30 as opposed to new hires that are coming in at lower pay, which is what the current rate projection is. So our projected payroll is increasing from, you can see, $2.885 billion to just over $3 billion. Although the underlying costs for the DB members are not changing, because we're dividing by a higher payroll figure, the percentage goes down. And we're gonna see that if you just take the total cost divided by the 2853980 figure versus the current cost divided by 3008, the percentage comes down because our denominator is higher. So the state as an employer contributes the full actuarial rate. So from the previous slide, the total rate was 29.16 in the middle, times the projected payroll of 2853980, times the percentage of the total payroll that's attributable to the PERS state employees, which is just under 50%. So that is the $414,945,000. Then we do the same calculation under HB 78. The DB, the total rate from the previous from slide 31 is 30.22%, times the higher payroll times the same percentage, and that's $453,271,000. So those numbers, if you go back to the earlier slide where we showed the table of numbers through FY39. These are the figures that you'll see for FY30. Now, the next bullet is sort of critical. This affects both PERS and TERS, and this is the distribution of the employer contributions. The portion of the DB rate that is going to be paid by the employers is projected to decrease from 14.33% to 11.91%. The 14.33% is the 22% statutory rate minus the rate that they pay for the DCR members, which is 7.67. Under HB 78, they are going to pay the 22% statutory rate minus the DCR rate, which in this case is zero, minus the HB 78 rate, which is 10.09. That equals 11.91. So the defined So the employers continue to pay 22%, but they're now paying less toward the unfunded liability, and that decrease has to be made up by the state. So now we calculate the additional state contribution rate. It's the total rate, the DB rate of 21.49 minus the portion paid by the non-state employers, which was from the previous slide was 14.33. And then we have that half-year interest adjustment. That equals 6.91%. And under HB 78, it's the DB rate of 20.13 minus the smaller percentage that they're expected to pay toward the DB rate, which is 11.91%, and that's 7.94. So then in the final bullet, we multiply those percentages from the previous bullet times the total payroll times the portion of the pay that's for the non-state employers, and you can see the additional state contribution is projected to increase from just under $99 million to just under $120 million. So there's a lot of moving parts. There's the underlying costs themselves, and then how much of the unfunded liability is being paid by the employers. As that decreases, the state covers the shortfall via the additional state contributions. And then we can go through the same three slides for TERS, but it's a similar mechanics to that. So I know I went through that really quickly, but I know we have a time constraint.
I sure appreciate it, Mr. Kirshner. I have a new appreciation for what you do. There's a lot going on here for sure. I've got questions. We'll go as long as we can here. I know folks have to step out. It would be nice if other folks could hear the questions, but I suppose folks can go back and watch on Gavel if they would like to. And so we'll take some questions. If we need to, we can also pull Mr. Kirshner onto a teleconference if we've got more questions. So I've got questions from just two folks so far. That's Representative Galvin and then Stapp. Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Thank you so very much for being here and for your presentation through the chair. Through the Chair Foster, I do have a couple of questions, if I may. To begin with, it's around, I'm just kind of doing my back of the napkin numbers here for slide 32. I have come up with $38.3 million and maybe a bit more in terms of the FY30, with that example, state as employer contributions. And then I have 20.8 for the FY PERS, and considering, I guess, the value of what comes with the opportunity, as you went over on slide 28, that portion was really important to me to understand that the lifetime pension and the piece that I was not familiar with was the post-retirement pension adjustments. And I understand that if things get out of whack, that may be adjusted. But if you could walk through that piece, and I'm just trying to evaluate not knowing how one puts a value to this, like how much it means to an employee coming in. And how, and after you answer that question, if you could just answer the PRPAs, and then I have questions about the multiplier impact of when we do have a system like this back in place.
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. So the post-retirement pension adjustments are what you often hear referred to as cost of living adjustments, or COLAs, that most other states have, or almost all states have. And that's basically to provide some sort of purchasing power protection to the individual so that when they retire with, say, a $1,000 monthly benefit without a COLA, they're going to get $1,000 for the rest of their life, and it's not going to change, even though inflation is going to erode into that. So their purchasing power of that $1,000 benefit goes down. The post-retirement pension adjustments are attempted to help preserve some of that purchasing power. So your post-retirement pension adjustments are linked to the Anchorage CPI changes from year to year. So every year the CPI is determined, and then if you're under age 65, you get 50% of the of that increase to your benefit, and if you're over 65, you get 75%. So that's what the post-retirement pension adjustments are. Now, members of the defined benefit plan also receive, if they're a resident of Alaska, they receive a separate 10% COLA, which is a flat 10% of their benefits, not linked to inflation. Under HB 78, HB 78 members would not be eligible for that 10% COLA. So that's not included in our HB 78 costs, but it is something that current defined benefit members, the pre-2006 hires, do receive.
I see. Okay, thank you for that. Appreciate understanding the difference between what was, and this is a whole new product. I appreciate that. I have one more follow-up. And
Representative
Gellman? This one is as it relates to thinking about overall cost to the state. And you mentioned at one point that this presentation doesn't cover what would be valuable to the state in other ways. So the value of lower training costs. I have written a list. I've just wondered if you wanted, if there's more things you would add to it, or if you also have done any assessment about this. I'd like to hear. But training costs, retention costs, hiring bonus costs, which we've had to help a lot of different departments with, lowering overtime costs, and also lowering contractual costs when we can't fill particular roles. And then the other costs to the state that I think about are when we have longer-term teachers, for example, we see higher academic results and less need then for academic interventions, which are very expensive. So I can imagine a lot of ways where having consistent hiring and retaining of Alaskan public service workers is saving the state. And that part of the equation is important to me because I am adding that, you know, in 2030, there's a, you know, additional costs to the state as well. So the value is what I'm trying to learn more about, and wondered if you've done any of that assessment or if someone else has.
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative McGill, you're absolutely right. And as we state on slide 24, those other economic considerations have to be considered. We are the actuaries for the retirement systems, and we're only qualified to project the potential cost impact to the retirement plans, funding. An economist or other professional can evaluate the types of things you're talking about. But yes, those absolutely have to be considered. And once those cost estimates, or in this case savings, are evaluated, then you'd want to combine those with our cost increases to determine the potential total economic benefit to the state. But we're not qualified to provide that analysis.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. My other question is related to, given your experience in looking at defined benefits in other states and having an awareness of what the overall impact is to having them versus not having this opportunity, do you have any general statements to make based on what you've seen in other states?
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Gellin, I would say my personal opinion is I think defined benefit plans are beneficial to individuals as well as employers. They also provide good job security for actuaries because actuaries aren't needed for defined contribution plans. But putting that aside, defined benefit plans I think are generally considered to be preferable. But if they provide more valuable benefits, there's a cost to that. And the cost is what we've shown here. But yes, I absolutely believe that that there's a lot of potential positive outcomes and benefits to the state and the individuals to have a defined benefit plan, but there's potential risks and costs which is what we've tried to capture.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, the other question is, and this is very basic, on page 4, where you have, you're speaking about PERS versus TERS and their employee contribution. I just can't get my head wrapped around how there is such a higher percentage of the contribution in PERS versus TERS, and what I just, if you could help me understand that as a, and maybe the public too, it's just something that I'm, it seems like such a big difference. And I've seen that throughout. You're constantly talking about PERS versus TERS, and help us better understand that. I think it's related to those who are, yeah, thank you, Rep. Sapp. Those who are working in the peace officer, public firefighter, peace officer, et cetera, versus more a different type of employment. And if you could help me better understand that, I appreciate it.
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin. Unfortunately, I don't know the history. I mean, I know the history of, you know, but I think it was in 2008 mm-hmm. when those statutory rates were set. I was not involved back then. I don't know what the reasoning was for why PERS is 22% and TERS is 12.56. I apologize. I don't have that information.
Through the chair.
Follow up.
Just if you have any information about how other states work, things like that, if there's any general understanding about the difference between their work, or is it just the way they've been perhaps negotiated?
Mr. Kirshner?
Yeah, through the chair. Well, if we go to slide if we look at slide 12, which shows the defined benefit contribution rates for PERS, the actuarial rate is 22.74 and TERS is 25.48. That's before any employer contribution. So that's the total rate.
Okay.
So you can see they're in the same vicinity.
Right.
But how those costs are shared among the employers in the state is unique to Alaska in the sense that we have the 22% and 12.56. And again, how those were set and what the rationale was many years ago, I just don't have that information.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, and that may be irrelevant. And I think the other thing I just wanted to say as a statement is, from what I understand, Dr. Giraducci, who we did have here before the committee, they did an economic analysis for the Senate finance, the other body, and my understanding is that the estimate was that because of our retention and recruitment value for a different program, we may see a savings of around $76 million. So I really do appreciate you presenting this and look forward to more as we work through this. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. And we'll go to Representative Stepp, and then hopefully we'll adjourn out for the day.
I'll be super quick. Co-Chair Foster, I have questions, but they're technical in nature, so I won't get into them. I just want to go through a couple things. I think the disparity between the TERS and PERS is because TERS employees don't have SBS. That's why their employer contribution is different between the employees, too, i.e. you're paying for less benefit, right? So you have less contribution. But the second thing is, I'm curious, on your rate of your projected reduction in the employer, non-state employer contribution rate, even though we legally can make them pay 22% contribution, why would we do that and assume the liability on our end? Why wouldn't we just, as they clear the existing liability on the pension, the unfunded liability, why wouldn't we just keep their rate at 22% of contribution for the non-state employers? Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Stepp, under HB 78, the non-state employers would continue to contribute 22%. So there's no difference. But because the actuarial rate goes up, that increase falls to the state because the employer contribution is capped at 22%. Mm-hmm. So the excess goes right to the bottom line, the additional state contributions.
Yeah, follow up, Mr.
Representative Stepp.
Yeah, so the reason I asked that is because when we went to the 22% originally for municipal employees, the concept was when we paid off that unfunded liability that the municipalities would actually not have to continue at that 22% rate. So basically now we're saying, actually, we're going to have you continue at that 22% rate for in perpetuity. And my history is a little fuzzy because I wasn't around back then, at least not in this capacity. But I don't know if the expectation from the municipal governments was to kind of have that rate fixed in stone from now until the end of time. So my last point that I'll make here real quick is, I guess, point blank. So if all your assumptions work out, would the state ever incur an unfunded liability under this new plan through the chair?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, no. Our projections would, well, I shouldn't say that. Yes, there's a small unfunded liability, and that's because, and this is a really technical point, so I apologize for this, but because the FY26 contribution rates have already been adopted, and HB 78 would be effective 7/1/25, which is the beginning of FY26, there's that first year, the contributions coming in wouldn't be enough to cover the cost of the HB 78 benefits. But it doesn't fall below, that doesn't cause it to go anywhere near 90%, which is why those triggers don't come into play. But to answer your first question, no, we are not, when after FY39, currently the projected contribution rate drops precipitously because that big unfunded liability is fully paid. So, for example, I think PERS, the defined benefit rate drops from, somewhere around 20% down to like 2 or 3%. So employers would not be, would under current conditions, regardless of HB 78, current PERS participant employers would not be expected to keep contributing 22%, because after 2039, the total rate is less than 22%.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow up?
Yeah, so just technical, I guess, difference in statute. So by leaving the rate at that level, if you did have an unfunded liability, you could just kick it back to them on the new plan, I suppose. But I will say on slide 9, this is kind of my problem, and I ask every actuarial this, so don't feel too bad. If I go all the way back to 2000, okay, everything has been wrong in one direction, i.e. more liability to the state. Every time we revise our projections on these plans, the state has never been, the plan has never performed better than your expectations. It's always performed worse. So that's why we go back and we revise our rate of return. When we started back in 2000, it was like 8.75. So we've revised six times over the last 20 years, all one direction, downward, right? So when we had the initial thought here when this bill was rolled out, we talked about stress testing those projections and asking the chair to have you guys run this at 6.75. That's what we had Dr. Garaducci actually testify that you should probably run it at 7.5. And to see, we're still running at 7.25. So my question to you is very simply. See that $555 million mistake up there? Because we were wrong. Are you going to cut us a check for $550 million in the event that you're wrong again? And my argument to you is if you're right the other way and we have a $200 million net to you, we'll give you $200 million back.
Yeah, well,
Mr. Kirshner.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, no, I'm not going to pay you $550 million. But I will say if you look, for example, in 2021, when we had that great asset return, look at the very far right-hand column. The unfunded liability went down $579 million. So when we were doing the projections in 2021 and comparing those to the previous year's projections, our projections were more favorable. So it all depends on plan experience. I don't have control over what the assets earn. And why has the expected return, like you say, it was for many years it was above 8%. You're not alone. All public sector plans have been lowering their investment return because future expected returns on equities and other investments are lower now than they were 10, 15, 20 years ago. And so we've tempered our expectations, and we have to use, as I said earlier, we have to use assumptions that we believe are best estimates of future experience. It would be unrealistic if I came to you and said, let's use an 8.5% return on investment, and all of our numbers would come down because we'd be assuming more money will come from earnings rather than contributions. But that would be unreasonable because, in reality, that's not a reasonable assumption in today's world. 20 years ago, it might have been reasonable, but it's not today based on the asset structure and the investment allocation that the investment team is responsible for. So we use assumptions that we believe are reasonable based on facts that we know today. Those are, you know, 5 years from now, yeah, all these numbers are probably going to change because we'll have different assumptions. But that's why we run the experience studies every 4 years, so our assumptions don't get stale and outdated, that we try and keep them as current as possible.
Last poll, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Stale.
Yeah, thanks. I'm done. A bit of a cheeky question before, so. I will say, you know, one thing I've learned throughout this process is that in the entire history, if you aggregate all the public sector defined benefits planned ever, which I learned in one of our economic studies we talked about, the average rate of return is 6.85. That's over the lifetime of the entire plans. So for me, I don't understand why, when we would look at something on a long-term projection, why would we would use a number that we know is probably going to get revised down again based off current economic conditions over time. And I don't understand why we wouldn't, like, compare this to at least the average rate of return throughout the lifetime of DB plans that we have. So I guess, through the chair, I expect in another 5 years or maybe 7 years, no matter what plan we have, the assumptive rate of return is going to go from 7.25 down to 7, or maybe from 7% down to 6.85. And when that happens, like, our costs as a state government and our projections in these go up because our plans are not making the same money. So is it that challenging to, like, be able to show us what it would look like if the plan only returned, say, 6.85, or let's just say 50 basis points different from what our current projection is, through the chair?
Mr. Kirshner?
Through the chair, Representative Stepp, no, it's easy for us to do that. If we were to run this analysis at, say, 6.75 instead of 7.25, our current projections would all come up, because we'd be expecting less earnings from the invested assets, so our contributions have to come up to make up the difference. So our current baseline numbers would come up, as would the HB 78 numbers, but the difference between them would be similar to what we're currently projecting. It just, they would all be higher, but the delta between current and HB 78 would be similar ballpark to what we've done. So, I mean, we can certainly run everything at a different rate, like 6.75, but I suspect these increase decreases would probably be in the same magnitude. Like I said, if we ran it at 6.75, all of the numbers in the current column would come up. All of the numbers in HB 78 would come up, but the delta between the two would probably be pretty much the same as what it is now.
Okay, thanks.
I don't think they would change materially.
Thank you very much. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. Slide 23 on these risk-sharing provisions. The post-retirement pension adjustments, it says the Armed Board can reduce that, and the Armed Board can also increase the member contributions from 8% to 12%. Is this unique to this particular bill, or is this something that's going on in other states or other plans that you're aware of?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, there are some other states that have risk-sharing provisions in some of those states, the funded status of the plans are better because there's shared risk, so less risk to either the state or the plan sponsor. Containing these risk-sharing provisions is not unique to HB 78. This is becoming more common in the public sector world, but they're not. It's not widespread among all the states, but there are a handful of states that do contain either a hybrid defined benefit, defined contribution type of arrangement, or some sort of risk sharing where the employees share more of the risk versus, say, a fixed rate, which is what we have now in the defined benefit plans.
And follow up. So, in any of those other plans, does it have a board that it's not mandatory? It's like you may do this. Are there any states that say your trust fund goes down to 90%? It automatically increases the rate from 8 to whatever, you know, any percentage point. Are there any automatic raises or limitations on any of those plans?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, I don't have the information off the top of my head, but there are some plans where it's not a subjective decision by the governing board like it is here, but they may be triggered not necessarily by a fund the funded status, but if the rate of return for a particular year falls below a certain level, then there might be some risk sharing among the members. So it depends. Every state that has risk sharing provisions can be different, and some of them are automatic, as opposed to, as in this case, it's up to the ARM board.
Representative Tomaszewski?
Would it be better, more reasonable, to keep the plan afloat, make it easier, more fluid, that they were just automatic, so they wouldn't be subject to the pressures of raising it or lowering it? It's just an automatic to keep the fund at 100% or within a acceptable range. Those automatically taken care of. Would that make this plan a little better?
Mr. Kushner?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, I would think that if, for example, if the trust falls below 90%, it says the ARM board can increase the HB 78 member contribution rate. But if there was an automatic trigger that said it must go to, say, 10%, as opposed to the ARM board saying, well, we'll increase it to 8.5%, which is a subjective increase, and, you know, other factors come into play. So, yeah, if it's not a subjective decision and it's an automatic adjustment, that would provide more protection that the risk-sharing provisions are intended to provide, that they would kick in automatically as opposed to only if the ARM board decides to do it, because other pressures might come into play.
Political pressures. There's always something going on. So, yeah, thank you for that answer. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Kushner. I'm going to have my staff, Mr. Brody Anderson, reach out to the representatives who are not here and find out if they have questions and if they would like a follow-up with Mr. Kushner. For the representatives here at the table, if you do have any questions, if you could let Mr. Anderson know, and then we'll figure out whether or not we need to bring him back for a teleconference to do some more follow-up questions. And then the other thing is we were hoping to put forth a committee substitute for HB 78 here. Would like to have the full committee here so that they could all hear what the changes are. And so we won't do that right now. What I'd like to do maybe is have that done tomorrow at our 1:30 meeting. We'll roll out the CS. I was going to set an amendment deadline, but without having that CS, you won't know which amendments to write the your amendments to which version of the bill, and not knowing what the changes are. So we'll look at maybe setting that amendment deadline tomorrow if it seems appropriate. Was looking at doing that for next Monday, so maybe keep that in mind. And our next meeting is next Monday, our next meeting is tomorrow at 1:30 p.m., and at that meeting we'll be hearing two other bills after we take up HB 78, and that's SB 57, the capital budget, and HB 91, that's the marijuana tax, retail stores, and registration bill. So if there is nothing else to come before the committee, Mr. Kirshner, we appreciate your time. Thanks for flying in, and we'll be adjourned at 4:20 p.m.